And in those notes, I mean, they provide some details of how to do the arithmetic that I don't do in the Blackboard, like how to derive the, for example, the third derivative of this is zero. So unless people ask me, I mean, I don't think there's much point in me doing arithmetic that you can do as well as me that's in the notes. But so that's why I am skipping such things. But if something in the logic is not clear, you should definitely ask me. And if you really want, we can do it in the Blackboard arithmetic, but I don't think that's very educational. That's point number one. Point number two, I was told that people are familiar with the notion of a beta function, but maybe not familiar with the notion of an anomalous dimension. Is this a correct statement? No means that. Are you familiar? Okay. Okay, one yes. Who doesn't know what an anomalous dimension is?
I mean, we have heard of it, maybe some calculation involved, but to understand it and to really knowing how it enters in context and connects with other, that's kind of blurry.
Sure. Do you want me to like spend 2 minutes doing that or no?
So we learned it technically, but we are not comfortable when we talk about it.
That's the thing, yeah.
Okay. So I mean, I shouldn't take too much. So, but you've seen it in some course or?
Yeah, like David was talking about it.
OK, yeah. Let me just say something quickly. And actually, maybe we should do a homework, even though it's not really directly. OK, it's somewhat directly relevant to the course. We can do a homework about computing anomalous dimensions so that people get an intuition. OK, so where does this thing come from? It comes from the fact that when you start study quantum field theory, you have to renormalize it. And essentially, you have to. In nice theory, essentially what you have to do is a coupling constant renormalization. These are you're familiar with. This has to do with the beta function. But you also have to do a wave function renormalization. Of operator. Okay. And essentially, the anomalous dimensions follow from precisely this fact, the fact that in a quantum field theory, you have to renormalize your operators. And this introduces a quantity, which it's called anomalous dimension. And I will try to sketch why that is the name that we give it. The fact that you have to do wave function renormalization is not surprising. I mean, even in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, when you do perturbation theory, and you write the new wave function after the perturbation, you have to renormalize the wave function so that it has norm one. Okay. So in quantum field theory, we have to do the same thing. Because in quantum field theory, we have to deal with divergences and the whole renormalization procedure. So I think the simplest way to understand why we give it this name is the following. So if I write this equation, do I have to explain more or not? If I write an equation like mu dd mu plus the, imagine we're doing lambda phi to the fourth. Okay, this depends on the number of operators, but okay, let's say. Acting on a correlation function of n phi's is a function of, say, momenta, the particles, lambda, and the running scale. Does this equation, do you know where this equation comes from? Have you seen this equation before? Yeah? I mean, this equation essentially is the statement that you can compensate a scale transformation by changing your coupling constant and by wave function renormalization. Okay. And this guy, okay, so the wave function renormalization is essentially the statement that you have an operator and you introduce this wave function renormalization constant. And this gamma essentially is the, okay, different books have different, slightly different definitions, but morally, up to factors of two and stuff like that, the different books, the different conventions, is the dependence of the wave function normalization on the scale. Okay? Essentially, it means that you can compensate the change of scale by changing the z and by a change of coupling constant. So now, this guy that's called anomalous dimension. So why do we call it like that? So let's take the possible simplest case of a two-point function, okay? And even simpler, let's take, which was the case, for example, relevant for the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Let's look at this equation at a fixed point of normalization group, okay? Which means that at a point, this is a function of lambda, okay? Everything is a function of lambda, where beta lambda star equals zero. Okay? So that's what we mean by the scale invariant theory. So what does this equation tell us for this theory? It tells us that mu gd mu plus 2 gamma. Okay, so I'm doing a two-point function now. 2 gamma of lambda star acting on g2, which is a function of p and the coupling and the scale equals zero. Okay. What does this equation tell us? I'll write the answer, and you tell me whether this makes sense. It tells us that g2, this function, has this scaling. Has 1 over g2 squared times are the signs right? I think so. Signs are right, right? So this just tells you that this function scales homogeneously with mu and by dimensional analysis with p. Okay? So you see that we have changed so we're looking at a two-point function of pi. So we have changed the momentum dependence of the two-point function by some scale factor gamma lambda, this gamma, right? You probably have more intuition about scaling weight, scaling dimension from position space. So if you want to go to position space, it will be like phi x, phi zero. You have to do the Fourier transform of this beast, right? So ddp e to the ipx, 1 over p squared. Okay, I can forget about the mu squared now. This is just there to the units make sense. So you have p squared minus 2 gamma lambda star. Okay? So what is this? If you do this Fourier transform, what do you get? Sorry, this should be let me write it better. So p squared. No, okay, minus 2. Yeah. What's the Fourier transform of this?
Can you count it?
No. This has a definite, I mean, the easiest way to do it is, just, I mean, you can apply it into Mathematica, but that's way overkill because this integral has a scaling symmetry, right? So it has to scale with 1 over the x to some power. So this has d. And this has d minus 2 minus 2 gamma, okay? So that means that this scales like 1 over x to d minus 2 gamma lambda star, okay? Now, if we were doing a Gaussian theory or Gaussian free theory, the two-point function would be you would get 1 over x to the minus 2, right? But in general, if you are at an interacting theory, you see that the way the two-point function scales with x has been modified from d minus 2 to d minus 2 minus 2 gamma. So that's why this is called anomalous dimension. Yes.
But may I ask a babyish founding question, that why it actually appears? I mean, okay, it appears, but why? What is the physical reasoning behind its appearance?
Physical reasoning is that if you compute the two-prime function, the power law behavior, I mean, this is physics here, right? This is what people that, like in the lab, when you measure divergence of various thermodynamic quantities, what they measure is precisely this.
But can we give a geometrical meaning to it?
Geometrical? Well, this is geometrical. I mean, it tells you the scaling behavior and the rescaling, space-time rescaling. I mean, the precise statement is that it tells you this, so that if I take an operator and I rescale time, I rescale coordinate. It tells you that the phi scales like this. Okay, so for one, it will be the d minus 2 over 2 minus gamma lambda star phi. It tells you how, if you take the Schrodinger transformation, how much the operator scales itself. And this definitely has physical meaning. Anyway, this was a bit of a detour, but since I was told that maybe this was not so clear and why where the name came from. Here it is. I may give you an exercise to compute this in, say, phi cube theory or something like that. I mean, you may have already done it in one of the courses, I don't know, but in which case, maybe, can we check if they have done this?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we know that the field phi is homogeneous, but we want to determine its degree of homogeneity.
Well, in general, and this is what we did. At a fixed point, first of all, if you're not at a fixed point, there is no scale symmetry, right? So there is, if you don't have a symmetry, you cannot ask how things transform under that symmetry if the symmetry is not there. So this homogeneity transformation is there in the fixed point. But even in a massive theory, like if you have a massive theory, you can integrate this equation. This you may also have done in courses. There is a formal way of integrating this equation that will write the two-point function as a function of beta and gamma, and you have some mass scales and so on. Just that in the conformal invariant point, the mass scales drop out and get a scaling homogeneous scaling behavior. Okay, so let's quickly now discuss what we did yesterday, so that we thermalize a little bit. So we discussed yesterday just geometry. We studied conformal transformations, which are just, by definition, angle-preserving coordinate transformations of this type. So we just change coordinates in some particular way. And we studied those conformal transformations that are connected to the identity, which means that the coordinate transformation is close to the identity. So the new point is mapped to the original point plus a small deviation. And derived the most general solution to the conformal transformations of this type. These are solutions of this conformal Killing vector equation that we derived. Was it clear where this came from in yesterday's class? Yes? No? Yes? I mean, no one says anything, so I don't know. Yes? Okay. And then, as I didn't show it in the blackboard, but it's straightforward to show that this equation implies that the third derivative of the conformal Killing vector vanishes, and we parameterize the most general solution to this equation. It has a finite dimensional space of solutions in above two dimensions. In two dimensions, it's infinite dimensional. And we associated to each parameter that parameterizes one of these conformal Killing vectors a space-time symmetry generator. So we had these two guys that you are very familiar with, or you should be very familiar with, which are just the Lorentz transformation. So translations and rotation, a Lorentz transformation. Then we define this guy that's obviously a dilatation. All that it does is rescale x homogeneously. And then we have this slightly crazy looking quadratic thing that I will try to motivate a bit more today, what the physical meaning is. But it's something that is kind of looks nonlinear, it changes x to x squared. So that's why it's weird. We are have intuition about linear things, nonlinear things. Most of us are not have much intuition about that. And then we showed that the symmetry algebra generated by these conformal Killing vectors, this is the conformal algebra by definition. It's the algebra of infinitesimal conformal fields, conformal vector fields. I remember I wrote a formula that made manifest. Okay, I show you. You have to check that what I said is true, but it's true. That you can make clever combinations of these generators of the conformal algebra such that they span the algebra SO2, D, the SO2, or SO1, D minus 1, depending whether you're in Minkowski or Euclidean. Okay? So now let me say a few more things. Maybe more global things and introduce one guy that it's going to be it's kind of very useful and important to know. So here I was discussing transformations that are connected to the identity. Okay? But you can also have transformations that are not connected to the identity. And in particular, one that plays an important role is inversion. Transformation. We'll call it, we'll even give it a name, I. So this is a transformation that looks like that. Okay. It's clearly not connected to the identity. In particular, exchanges 0 and infinity, right? And it has the property that squares to 1. If I do 2 consecutive inversion transformations, I get back to the same point. Okay? It's a Z2, I mean, in the usual language, it would be a Z2 transformation. So something that squares to 1.
May I?
Yes.
Is this Z2 times the conformal group the most general group that maps circles to circles?
We'll go back to it in a second. Yeah. I have to talk a little bit more about the topology of the conformal group. The statement that is correct is that you can get the conformal group. Okay, one statement that one reason why these versions are useful is that the conformal group can be generated by just Poincaré plus inversion. Okay. We'll see a bit more why this is the case. One thing that's important about this is that this guy is a transformation that exchanges the unit sphere with the complement. Yes.
So how do you get scale transformations from Poincaré and inversion?
Okay, so we'll see it in a moment.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, if it was obvious, I mean, it's not obvious, right?
It's not.
Yeah, okay, so we'll have to go through it, yeah. So first I have to tell you why inversion is useful. So there is this crazy thing called a special conformal transformation. But now you can imagine what can you do to what you can do is you start conjugating the things that you know, like you know about Poincaré, so you can conjugate Poincaré and see what you get. Okay. So imagine I take translations and I conjugate by inversion. So I do an inversion, I do a translation, and then I do an inversion back. Given the formulas that you know, this will give you something, a transformation that maps x mu to x mu plus b mu x squared, 1 plus 2 b dot x. And you can check this. This is really an elementary exercise. Would people know how to do this? Yes? OK. Yeah. And now we can check that this transformation has a nice property that if I look at an infinitesimal transformation, so V very small. The smallest of the transformation is measured by this parameter V that measures the infinitesimal transformation. you get this. You get what am I doing? Ah, yes. Okay. Notice that this is precisely the infinitesimal mu transformation. The crazy one that we didn't have much intuition about. So what this means is that you can think of a special conformal transformation as the kind of the most intuitive thing you can think about. I think you all have an intuition about what inversion does. It exchanges the origin with infinity. So a special conformal transformation is something that conjugates translation. Okay. And roughly speaking, this is heuristic, roughly speaking, just like translations keep the infinity fixed, special conformal transformations keep the origin fixed. You can check, you can just see here, that the origin is invariant under the special, x equals 0 is invariant under the special conformal transformations, and a translation obviously keeps infinity fixed. So they have this kind of dual perspective. So I notice, since I applied it twice, this is part of the connected part. Okay. So notice that by conjugate. Okay. So now I'll try to answer your question without. I'll say it in words. It should be clear now. Since I get k by conjugating by I, how would I get d? The way I would get d is that. So now, I now have constructed for you p mu, m mu nu. And k mu, right? Now, in order to get the missing one, I just have to look at the commutator of p mu with k mu that, if you remember, contained d. So you see that if I add two Poincaré inversions, I get the whole conformal algebra. Okay? Good. So now, just like the Poincaré group has four disconnected components, the conformal group has also four disconnected components. Remember, in the case of Poincaré, we have what's called the proper orthogonal Lorentz group, which is the actual symmetry of any relativistic quantum field theory. And then you have three disconnected pieces that involve parity, time reversal, and parity times time reversal. Okay? So there's a very similar structure going on here. So we have, okay, the names, I'm not sure the names are very universal, but I'll just write some names. So this is the one that's connected to the identity. And this is the symmetry group of any, so this is a symmetry of all conformal field theories. Just like the proper orthogonal subgroup of the Lorentz group is a symmetry of all relativistic field theories. And we're going to denote those elements by, say, lambda. So lambda is some matrix that generates this transformation. Then you can append to this three disconnected parts. One is you take inversion times any element here. Then you can take a time reversal and conjugated by any element of the connected part. And then I can take, so T, sorry, T is time reversal. And then I can just do IT. And these are the three other components that the theory, that the conformal group has. Again, and all that a theory has to have is invariance under SO 2,4, the connected component. Now, there is one guy that's missing here that I described earlier. So which one is missing? Which discrete transformation from the Lorentz group is missing here? Parity. So something that you're invited to think about is to show that parity sits here. So that parity is conjugate by a usual conformal transformation connected to the identity to inversion. Okay. So this tells us two important things, that a conformal field theory is invariant under inversion, if and only if it is invariant under parity. Okay. And there are conformal field theories that are not invariant under parity and therefore are not invariant under inversion. So one has to be somewhat careful. One hint. Anyway, let me. If you want to think about it, think about it. There is a very nice way that unfortunately I don't have time to discuss, but I think it's in the notes, in some version of the note that existed at some point. There is a very nice way of thinking about conformal transformations. You know, the nice thing about conformal transformations is that they're nonlinear. So there is a way of linearizing them by realizing the SO2 comma D as a linear transformation. So over which space does SO2 comma D act naturally, linearly? Some Minkowski space-time with two-time direction. And then you can essentially embed Minkowski space into that space. And the linear transformations that act on the, it's like, okay, the analogy is the following. If you look at SU2 transformation, they act naturally on the embedding coordinates of the sphere. But then you can parameterize the curved coordinates of the sphere in terms of the embedding ones, and then the transformations become nasty. So the idea is exactly the same. You can provide an embedding of Minkowski space into the higher dimensional space. The transformations in the higher dimensional space are completely trivial. They're just linear transformations that you know. And you recover these transformations by writing the embedding of Minkowski into the higher dimensional. Yes?
What in the embedding makes the reduction nonlinear? So, it can be, but it's not completely clear, maybe.
Yeah, so maybe I can explain it in private, or we can do an exercise. This would be a little bit of a derail. Mm-hmm. But think of the example of the coordinates on the sphere. How do you relate the coordinates on the sphere to the coordinates in the embedding of the sphere? It's roughly speaking, the idea is exactly the same. Okay, so for now that's all I'll want to say. Okay, so one thing I didn't ask you to, but you can check. I just made the statement that this is the conformal transformation. Just check that indeed, that if I compute dx mu, dx mu, you're going to get some conformal factor times dx mu, dx mu, which is what you mean by a conformal transformation. Okay. Good. So this somehow completes the geometrical part of the discussion. We understood what the symmetries are, what is the conformal group. We even talked about this important guide inversion that together with Poincaré generates everything. But now we have to go back. We want to do physics here, not just geometry. So now we have to start talking about field theories that realize these symmetries. Okay. So the first statement that we know from standard quantum field theory is that any Poincaré invariant quantum field theory has a symmetric and conserved energy momentum tensor. So that's the statement that it's conserved and that it's symmetric. And as usual, okay, yeah, that's the first thing. And what I derived in class together with the homework, I don't know how many people did the homework, that particular homework, but was to show that a conformal field theory has a special property that it admits an energy momentum tensor that is traceless. Okay. Is this statement, do people understand what these words mean? A conformal field theory has an energy, okay. To convince you that this is not crazy, you can try to take a massive scalar field and, for example, show that there is no way of making T mu mu zero. And what you will find is that there is a violation of the trace of T mu mu that's proportional to m squared phi squared. Okay. So we should think of the trace of T mu mu as a measurement of broken conformal symmetry. Okay. So we said that any conformal field theory has to be invariant under these symmetries, right? Symmetry generators, Poincaré plus dilatations plus special conformal. And we know that any symmetry in quantum field theory has to have an associated conserved current. So question. So what is the conserved currents corresponding to the conformal symmetry generator? Can someone make a guess?
It's something to do with X mu T mu nu, but not exactly, because then you require traces, like, then you require it to be traceless, even though dilations don't require that.
You want to make an answer?
Okay, X mu T mu nu.
No, but it's for any conformal transformation. By telling you this, I've already given you a huge hint how to do it. We can do it in a way once and for all, not having to worry which one is which. Okay, so anyone else wants to give it a try? So we know two things. Okay, but by telling you this, I'm telling you essentially the answer, but anyway, part of the fun. So we already know that the energy momentum tensor is conserved. And we know that it's traceless. Now, we know that the symmetry is generated by a conformal killing vector that we write explicitly here. So this essentially should uniquely tell you the answer. No one will try?
Well, if I contract that equation with T mu nu.
Which equation?
That equation I have up there.
Here? This one or this one?
The upper one, maybe.
The upper one?
Or maybe I should go just this, to, yeah, the, if the, I contract T mu nu there, on this side I will do the trace, which is zero. And I don't know if that tells me anything.
But you were very, very close. So
okay. What
you would do is, this is the current associated to any transformation that's parameterized by this conformal killing vector, zeta.
Yeah.
That depends on all these parameters. So what I can do is I can just take T mu nu and contract it with the conformal killing vector. So why is this conserved? The reason that's conserved is that let's hit A mu, J mu on this. When it acts on T mu nu, it's conserved by virtue of Poincaré invariant, essentially. So I'm not writing it, so you get zero. And then I get plus T mu nu, D mu zeta nu. Now, we use the fact that in any Poincaré invariant theory, the energy momentum tensor is symmetric. So that means that I can write this as 1/2. I can symmetrize the indices, right? All that I did here is to use the fact that P mu nu is a symmetric tensor. But now, what is this? For a conformal killing vector, this guy is nothing but proportional to the metric. So this guy, essentially, of the factors, is eta mu nu, T mu nu, delta zeta. But a conformal field theory has precisely a traceless energy momentum tensor. So here I constructed for you the conserved currents associated to a conformal killing vector, conformal transformation. I see that it's kind of uniform in all transformations. All that you have to plug in is the corresponding killing vector. Okay, any questions about this stuff before I move on? Yes.
Do these currents or charges have a name?
Well, yeah, I mean, the charges definitely have a name. The charges are called dilatation, P mu. Yeah, so, okay, so maybe one thing that's not so clear.
We say momentum is conserved, angular momentum is conserved, but if it scales metric, then what is the thing that is converged?
D.
And I mean,
just the dilation operator, angular momentum operator, dilation operator.
Yeah. Okay, you want? Okay, so let's since you asked, let's write more explicitly the current associated to dilatation. That would be P mu nu x mu, right? Now, what would be the so, okay? So hopefully you know that for any conserved current there is a conserved charge. Let me try to be more. Can I erase something there? No. Let me say something in general. So you have a conserved current. You can define a conserved charge by integrating over space the time component. That just follows from the fact that if I hit it with a time derivative, I can use the conservation law and integrate by part. So that means that for the dilatation current, I keep raising and lower indices. I mean, this has no significance whatsoever, but let me try to be consistent. That means that the D, what I mean by D as an operator in the, say, in the Hilbert space of your theory, is D zero nu x nu. That's it. Just like for momentum, would be that.
So it's like momentum times position, which is like the area in the face, the volume in the face. Well, that means.
I mean, we haven't talked about phase space or anything yet, but it makes sense in the following sense that all space-time transformations have to do with the energy momentum tensor. So of course, all the currents will have to do with some energy momentum density times some space-time transformation. This also related to the fact that let's not derail. Yeah, is it intuitively clear where it's at? If you really want information phase space, you can do a Poisson bracket. You can prove by doing the Poisson bracket of P mu, say, with a scalar field, that it generates, that if you use the usual Poisson bracket, that this will generate a scale transformation on a field, acting on a field. Any other questions? So far we've discussed only one operator in a conformal field theory. And there are two operators that exist in any conformal field theory, which is the identity operator, which is boring, and the energy momentum tensor. But of course, CFTs have other operators. In physics, these are the ones that measure correlations in a near second order phase transition, for example, the spin-spin correlation and so on. So now we want to study what we want to get to is what constraints those conformal invariants give on the correlation function of operator in a CFT. Okay. So a CFT will come with a list of operators. Every different CFT comes equipped with a list of operators. That's one of the data that defines a CFT. You have a laundry list of operators. And our task in life is to learn how to compute the correlation functions of all these guys. Okay. And what we want to use is the constraints of conformal symmetry to see what is the most general form that the correlation functions can take. This game you have already, at least maybe not explicitly, but implicitly played for the case of Poincaré invariant, or for Poincaré invariant theories. For example, you know that if you take the two-point function of two operators, you know that the two-point function has to depend on what? If I give you 2 points, imagine I tell you in a Poincaré with no more symmetry, if I tell you that I have two operators, OX or Y, what can you tell me just based on Poincaré invariant?
That's pure Poincaré function. The distance.
Yeah, it has to be a function of the distance. So now what we're going to do is study what other constraints, if I add all these crazy guys, will give onto correlation functions. We'll see that they give a huge restriction. Essentially, in a Poincaré invariant theory, this can be anything, right? This can be an arbitrary function. Yes.
Are you assuming Bernoulli invariant?
No, I'm not. I'm just assuming. I'm just saying that. There are, if I have two points, the Lorentz invariant I construct from the point is the distance between the points.
Okay.
That's the Lorentz invariant, right? The distance between two points is the Lorentz invariant quantity.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay. So in a Poincaré invariant theory, what we do is we label operators, we classify operators according to their transformation properties under the Lorentz group or under the Poincaré group, right? We say it's a scalar, a vector, a spinor, and so on. So now we have to classify label operators into representations of the conformal group. So essentially what we want to do is to give some quantum numbers to the operator that tell us the properties of the operator under conformal transformation. So for the Lorentz invariant theory, all that I have to do is to tell you what is the spin of the operator, if it's spin a half or whatever. Here, in a conformal field theory, operators are labeled. Since, in particular, they're Poincaré invariant, they're going to be labeled by Lorentz quantum number. Plus the hero of the story, which is going to be the dilatation eigenvalue. Plus which tells us how we should rescale the operator as we perform a scale transformation in space-time. So these are, you see that now an operator has an extra label, which is the dimension of the operator. Okay. So remember one peculiar property of the conformal algebra is that we had this p mu and k mu, so translations and special conformal transformations that behave very differently with respect to dilatation. P mu is a raising operator, which means that if I have an operator of dimension delta, P mu acting on a delta has dimension delta plus 1. Okay. That's intuitive because P mu can be represented by a derivative. So if I do scale transformations, I add the dimension by 1. K mu is a lowering operator instead. So if I now act K mu on a delta, what I'm going to get is dimension delta minus 1. So it's a lowering operator, yes.
So K mu and P mu themselves have no anomalous dimension?
No. This is a very fundamental Macron quantum field theory that the energy momentum tensor has always dimension D. But these guys have no anomalous dimension. It's a very good point, yeah. And that's why essentially, in order to fully solve the theory, this is also an interesting operator in the theory, right? This will be like, if I give you a scalar field, just to give you an example, phi and d mu phi are different operators. But in a conformal field theory, the correlation functions of d mu phi are completely fixed in terms of the correlation functions of phi, because all that you care about is essentially the dimension. And the dimensions are fixed by the fact that p has dimension 1. OK, so this gives a definition. This idea that you can lower the energy by k mu leads to the definition of a primary operator. So this is an operator. So now operators furnish representations of the conformal group. And then there's a special operator, which is at the bottom of the tower, which is annihilated by k mu. This is, again, this is like the lowest wave state when you do angular momentum, or when you look at the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, whatever. So this is what defines a primary operator is an operator that's it's killed by special conformal generators, and then I can build a representation just by acting with all the other ones. In particular, if I act with p mu, let me write it here. So here I can build my family, which is an infinite dimensional family. So this will have a dimension. Delta, and this will have dimension delta plus n. And one of the important properties of conformal field theory is that the guys that essentially completely fix the theory are the primary operators. Okay? So our goal will be to understand the correlation functions of primary operators. The ones of descendants are completely fixed by conformal symmetry. So they are not interesting. Well, they're interesting, but they have no new information other than the primaries plus conformal symmetry. Good. So now what we want to know is...
Is that true in the point of space-time?
Sorry?
Is that the primary operator, is that true that KMU will annihilate them in any point of the space-time?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So that's the origin. This is a statement about the... So to be more precise, this is a statement at the origin. We will see how translation... So now, how would I translate the action of a special conformal transformations away from the origin? What I would use is kind of Heisenberg's equations of motion, and I would conjugate on the left and on the right by e to the ipx. And since p and k have Kuki commutation relations, you will see that the operator away from the origin has a non-trivial transformation. So that is the precise thing. But that's a good point. And we will probably come back to this if we study the operator state correspondence. OK, so essentially, operators are either primary. And the buzzword for these guys, all these other guys, are called descendant, for obvious reasons. OK, so now we want to look at operators that will represent the transformations of the operators and the conformal transformation that will represent the conformal algebra. So I do x goes into g tilde gx. Let me use this notation. So g is some choice of conformal transformation. And now I have to write something that will transform well, which means that it will represent the conformal group or the conformal algebra. So I'm going to take an operator Ox. So this is, primary. So when I do transformation, I have to transform the operator, right? So this guy will be labeled by, as I said, dimension, delta, and spin. Just to label the spin part, I'm going to use an index A. OK, this captures the Lorentz properties of the thingy. It could be a spinor, it could be a vector, it could be a tensor, whatever. So a conformal primary is an operator that under a transformation of this type, conformal transformation, under Lorentz, it does the usual thing that it would do. This is a Lorentz rotation. OK, there's a subtlety here, so let me, OK, I'll have to. Okay, what is R? R, okay, so let's see. So what was a conformal transformation? So it was something like delta x mu dx rho, delta x nu dx sigma, eta mu nu equals omega squared eta rho sigma, right? So this R is the following matrix. So R is a matrix. Mu rho. Which now is a function of x. Which has the property that it's orthogonal. It preserves the metric. Okay. So in a so if we were just doing Lorentz transformations, this would be a constant, right? Because this guy is not there, it's one. And this guy is just the constant Lorentz transformation. In a conformal transformation, you essentially mimic what you know from Lorentz, from standard quantum field theory, and you replace the Lorentz parameter by an x-dependent Lorentz parameter. Okay? But that is fixed in terms of, which is determined by the conformal transformation. And then this LIB just tells you whether what representation of the Lorentz group you're studying. And then there is a factor that is a Jacobian, like a density, that captures the information about the dimension. So this captures the information about the spin. This captures the information about the dimension. So this says that a primary operator of dimension delta transforms as a density with respect to, well, it transforms as a density under the isomorphism. Just like the square root of g, roughly speaking. Okay. Is the statement clear, at least?
What's that exponent?
Sorry?
What's that exponent?
Yeah, so that's delta is the guy I just defined. Is the extra label. And d is the space-time dimension.
Delta over d.
Delta over d.
Over d.
Yes.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Now, one question. This looks a bit funny. I mean, do people know why I act on the spin? So you can think of this. So there are two transformations always when you act on a field. There is the when you have a space-time transformation, there is the geometrical transformation that acts on the point on the operator. And then you have, so you could call this the orbital transformation. To make an analogy with Lorentz transformation, so how the field changes in space-time. And then there is an orbital part that tells you about the internal quantum numbers like spin. You should convince yourself that these guys have to transform in opposite ways in order for this to make a faithful representation of the transformation. So.
Why?
Sorry?
Why?
OK, so yes. Well, I will not explain, but I'll tell you how you can check it. So. Otherwise, if you make a transformation G3, which is G1 times G2, this equation should make sense, right? And it's only if you have a transformation here by G and G inverse that this will happen. And essentially, by checking this, OK, so since time is short, for checking this, this LA has to satisfy a very special property. It has to satisfy that L G1 LG2 is LG1G2, which is the statement that L is a representation of the transformation. Okay. Good. So this is kind of something that is reasonable. You can Okay, so in order to get some intuition, now we can look at an infinitesimal transformation. So now we take x mu to be x mu plus zeta mu. And we just want to compute what the infinitesimal change under this transformation is. Sorry, this is this, right? So delta OA of x is O tilde at x minus OA at x, right? Infinitesimal form. So you have a part that you could, that is obvious in a sense, which is the precisely what I call the orbital part. So this is just the way any field transforms under the diffeomorphism, right? Just by a derivative like that. Then there is a local Lorentz rotation. So this is a local Lorentz. Again, if we were using a Poincaré transformation, this would be constant. You will see now in a moment what this expression is. And then I have a scale transformation. Oh, sorry, I think I'm making a mess with indices. Right? And this is a scale transformation. Notice that the data is delta, and the data about the spin is this R. R is a representation of the Lorentz group. So you have to write the generators of the Lorentz group in that representation. Do these words make sense? What does that mean? So for example, for a vector, you can give the Lorentz transformation, the Lorentz generators in the vector representation, essentially by product of Kronecker deltas. You may have seen that. If not, we'll do an exercise. For spinors, you have to use the Clifford matrix, the Clifford algebra, the gamma matrix. Okay? Something like for a spinor, for example, is something like M, you know, is something like proportional to the anticommutator of two gamma matrices. This part is completely, this is nothing new than what you know from Poincaré. So if you know that, this is exactly the same. The only wrinkle is this guy. But now omega mu naught nx for a general conformal transformation has the usual Lorentz part, which is just constant, but it gets a contribution from the special conformal transformation. And this omega x, which is the small, it's a local dilatation. So if it was just a dilatation, it would be lambda, right? It's a constant scale transformation. But the special conformal always messes things up, and you get this. This is another way of seeing, in terms of fields, that a conformal transformation can be thought of as a local rotation and a local dilatation, because it transforms like a local rotation, right? And this is a local dilatation. So another question, how do you know that this is, okay, so what? So this is how a primary transform. Notice that the descendant, and this I'll leave you to check. Imagine you look at the descendant, like d mu of OA. D mu OA will not transform like this. Even though you can deduce the transformation properties of d mu OA by using the conformal algebra, but it will not transform like this. The primaries, in a sense, are the tensors. They transform tensorially, nicely. The other ones are more messy, but completely determined. So now one thing that you can do is that just from geometry, so how do we know that this transformation makes sense? We know from geometry, just from the Killing vectors, that if I looked at the B derivative of two conformal Killing vectors, I get a different conformal Killing vector. Okay? In order to show that these fields are representing the conformal algebra, what one has to check is that if I do a variation of this type, yeah, so here maybe to be more very concrete, this is a transformation under a particular conformal Killing vector. OK? Okay. It's parameterized by some conformal Killing vector. What you have to check is that delta zeta 1, delta zeta 2 equals acting on the conformal primary, OA, is delta zeta 3 of OA. Yeah. That's a statement that OA represents the conformal algebra. So this is great. So we essentially know how operators transform in the conformal transformation. And I think I said 2 minutes late, so I'll just take a couple of minutes to tell you what would have to go next. The next part is essentially, conceptually, I think it's very clear. The algebra might be a bit messy, so I have to decide how much I should do in the blackboard and how much you want me to do in the blackboard. But essentially now what you want to do is you want to constrain correlators. Of primary operators, okay? In a conformal field theory. So we're in a conformal field theory. We have the conformal symmetry acting on our operators. They transform in these very nice ways for the conformal, for the primary operators. What is the statement that conformal symmetry imposes on correlators? So let's look at a particular correlation function. Just for concrete, let's look at the two-point functions. Imagine I have an operator O1 at x1, O2 at x2. Okay, that will be like, actually, the simplest. You could also look at the one-point function, and you will convince yourself very quickly that there's something very special about the one-point function that you will figure out. So what are the constraints that conformal symmetry imposes on this? There are several ways of saying it. The infinitesimal version is the statement that delta zeta acting on the correlation function vanishes. That's just a statement that the correlation function is invariant under conformal transformations. What in more detail, what does this mean? It means, you know, variations act obey the Leibniz rule. So that means that the correlation function of delta zeta O1 x1 times O2 x2 plus O1 x1 delta zeta O2 x2 has to vanish. So one way to read this equation is to say, okay, I know how delta z, how the variation, infinitesimal variation is of this type, right? And now I look at each transformation separately. The way you should think of this equation, so this is some function of x and 1 x2 that, let's be agnostic, and I don't know anything about this. The way you should think about this is as a differential equation. One way to think about it is that this is a differential equation for f of x1, x2. As was discussed before, you're familiar with this, okay? You're familiar with this. If you're using Poincaré transformations, what you would derive, this, if you wish, is too sophisticated to do it for the case of Poincaré, because in Poincaré, I mean, you know from whenever that what are the invariants given 2 points. But in general, if I give you a special conformal transformation, you may struggle to know how you construct an invariant out of that mess. But so the systematic way of doing it is you write a differential equation. And for example, in the case of Poincaré, you will find what we said, that x1, x2 is a function of the distance. Okay? But now, okay, so that's essentially the game you want to play. So, maybe I'll leave it as an exercise to prove the two things. So that you can also act on this on the one-point function on a conformal field theory. This in a, yeah, so this need not be zero in a standard theory, but in a conformal field theory. So okay, show this follows. Actually, for the one-point function, you don't even need, just thinking about it will tell you immediately, because you can get to the answer without even talking about special conformal transformations. You can just get it from dilatation. but show that the one-point function of a primary operator has to vanish unless it's the identity operator. Two, prove that if I have O delta 1 x 1, so I have an operator of a conformal primary of the main. OK, to simplify things, one thing I should say very clearly, to simplify things, now we're talking about operators that are scalars under the Lorentz group. We will have to discuss at some point the constraints that conformal symmetry imposes on correlation functions of the energy momentum tensor. This is like the god of the one of the gods of the theory, so we have to understand that. But just to warm you up, let's assume that OA are scalars under Lorentz. So one thing I wanted you to show is that special conformal transformations is remarkably fix completely the space-time dependence of this guy to be, first of all, the two-point function will vanish unless the dimension of this guy equals the dimension of this guy. That's a huge selection rule, right? Tells you that amazing number of two-point functions just vanish on the nodes. So it's completely fixed. And this tells us something important physically. It tells us that if you want to measure the dimension of an operator, the scaling dimension of an operator, what you do is you measure the two-point function. If you know the two-point function of your operators, it's equivalent to saying that you know the spectrum of dimension. So from here, you can read off the spectrum of dimensions. Or experimentally, when they measure correlations, they're, essentially they're measuring these exponents, which are measuring the dimension. And let me just, so these are, I want you just to think. So if I take the three-point function, it turns out, again, that it's completely fixed up to some function. So here, I can fix the coefficient here by normalization of my operator O. But once I have normalized O, the coefficient of the three-point function is physical. And this, am I going to mess it up? Let me see, so. So, okay, xij means xi minus xj. So let me count, so. I guess the more conventional thing is you want to make invariants, you could write it like this. Okay. So again, it's completely fixed. And the thing I want you to convince yourself is that imagine that we did not impose all the symmetries, but we imposed P mu, Lorentz, and D only. What would be the most general three-point function if I imposed this only? And I want you to see that the fact that you have a special conformal symmetries really gives you a huge simplification to the problem. Because what you should be able to convince yourself here is that there are arbitrary functions that are not determined by a conformal symmetry that you would have to compute. There is dynamics there. While that if you add now k mu, it's completely fixed and all that you have to determine is one coefficient. Okay. So this is a very manifest way of seeing how conformal symmetry is a huge constraint on the possible dynamic. And that's why we can get very far with conformal field theories, because we can constrain them very much. OK, so I'll continue tomorrow. Any questions about this? Do people think they know how to determine this? Do I need to do this on the class or not? That's a question. Does anyone want me to do it on the class? OK. Either you're very shy or very confident. OK, good. No, it's really, I mean, this shouldn't be difficult. OK, good.